Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour. This is David Corey, along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us. Richard, how's it going?
Hey, David, good evening, and happy President's Day to everyone. We have another informative program tonight. I want to remind veterans that this is your show. So if you have a question or comment, call us now or during the rest of the show at 1-888-627-6008. That's 1-888-627-6008.
Yep, tonight we're going to talk about a number of topics, including developments this past week in the Department of Veterans Affairs. We are also going to spotlight some proposed legislation. In our military humor segment, we'll offer some levity for your listening enjoyment. In our veterans history segment, with a nod to President's Day today, we'll recognize presidents who are veterans. Next, we're going to discuss some information about upgrading a discharge characterization, particularly for veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder. And in our final segment, called Hurley's Tips, Richard Hurley will share some very practical and very useful information for veterans.
But first, let's start with the developments this past week. This past week, the Senate voted to confirm the nomination of Dr. David J. Shulkin as the new VA secretary by a vote of 100-0. I think he's the first one to get such a vote. Dr. Shulkin was officially sworn in on Tuesday, February the 14th. Now he begins the hard work of tackling many challenges facing the VA, including being understaffed by over 45,000 personnel, most on the VA healthcare side. As we have discussed in previous weeks, we expect Dr. Shulkin to work with Congress to develop ways to help veterans get the medical care they need, including expanding the reliance on the private sector when the VA health system cannot provide care in a timely way. We also wait with great anticipation to see what the VA under Dr. Shulkin's leadership does, along with Congress, to address the broken VA disability claims appeal system, where cases stagnate for years before decisions are made, with currently in the neighborhood of 480,000 claims in various stages of the appeal system. There is a backlog which is expected to grow in upcoming years. In past shows, we have discussed some legislative ideas, including some very bad ones, which have been offered to change the VA appeal systems. We'll talk more about that later tonight. Other Washington news of interest to veterans include more legislation offered in Congress this past week. David, as I understand, you have some information on that topic for us tonight.
Yes, this past Thursday, February the 16th, according to a congressional press release, House Committee on Veterans Affairs Chairman Phil Rowe, a Republican from Tennessee, along with Representatives Brad Winstrup from Ohio and Mike Conaway from Texas, introduced a bill called the Veterans Second Amendment Protection Act. This bill would prohibit the VA from considering any beneficiary who is assisted by a fiduciary as mentally defective without a magistrate or judicial authority ruling that the beneficiary is a danger to themselves or others. Let me give you some background leading up to this proposal. Under the current practice, if a veteran or other beneficiary of the VA is appointed a fiduciary, that means some independent party to manage their VA benefits, particularly their financial benefits. If a veteran is appointed a fiduciary from the Department of Veterans Affairs, then they are labeled as mentally incompetent in the VA system, and the department automatically sends the veteran's name to the Federal Bureau of Investigation's National Instant Criminal Background Check System, the NICS. Inclusion on the NICS list may prohibit the beneficiary from legally purchasing or owning a firearm. A beneficiary may apply for relief from the firearms prohibition included in the current policy, but that leaves the VA bureaucrat, not a magistrate or other judicial authority, with the power to determine whether or not relief is warranted. Now, as further background, this appointment of a fiduciary to manage a veteran or other VA beneficiary's money can be triggered as simply or by nothing more than a psychologist or psychiatrist answering a checklist, one of which has a question asking whether the veteran is able to manage his or her own funds. That's it. Managing funds. That can trigger the appointment of a fiduciary. So many veterans have expressed the concern over the years that simply because they might have difficulty for whatever reason of managing funds doesn't mean that they are a danger to themselves or to other people. And yet, simply by checking yes to that question, a doctor may trigger this entire process where a veteran may lose his or her right to possess a firearm. So in this past week's press release, Congressman Roe, he stated, quote, "The freedoms granted by the Constitution should apply to all Americans, especially the men and women who have been willing to risk their lives to protect those freedoms. This common-sense bill would ensure no veteran or beneficiary is declared mentally defective simply because they utilize a fiduciary." Congressman Wenstrup also said, quote, "For the men and women who have worn the uniform of this country, to be denied the very constitutional freedoms they fought for is unconscionable. Veterans shouldn't be forced to choose between utilizing the resources they've earned at the VA and exercising their Second Amendment rights." Congressman Conway added, quote, "All too often, government bureaucracies fail the heroic men and women who have fought for our freedom. In this case, the same department that was created to help veterans is taking away one of their most important constitutional rights, the right to bear arms. I'm glad that Chairman Roe and Congressman Wenstrup, they have them on board with this important legislation to ensure that no veteran is wrongly denied their rights under the very Constitution they serve to protect. Again, this bill, if enacted into law, would prohibit the VA from considering any VA beneficiary who is assisted by a fiduciary as mentally defective for purposes of gun ownership, unless there's been a magistrate or a judicial authority ruling that the beneficiary is a danger to themselves or to other people."
Very interesting, David. And we have a client that affected just recently with regard to the Camp Lejeune situation. Another bill filed in Congress this week is H.R. 369, which is titled as the Eliminating the Sunset Date of the Choice Act. Here's the background of the bill. The Veterans Access Choice and Accountability Act of 2014, also known as the Choice Act, originally established the Veterans Choice Program. The Choice Act included language to state that the Department of Veteran Affairs is authorized to continue services until August 7, 2017, or until the funds provided under the Choice Act ran out, whichever occurred first. While the authorization is set to expire on August 17, 2017, the VA has informed Congress there will still be funds remaining in the Veterans Choice Program after August 7, meaning veterans could still access health care services under the Choice Act if Congress eliminates the sunset date. Should Congress eliminate the sunset date of the Veterans Choice Program, veterans utilizing the program can continue seeking care outside the VA under this authority, paid for with the funds that have already been appropriated. While Congress continues to pursue VA reform, VA Deputy Secretary Sloan Gibson sent a letter requesting Congress eliminate the sunset date last December. According to the House Veteran Affairs Committee press release, and I quote, "The VA is in dire need of wholesale reform, but veterans receiving care through the Choice Program should be allowed to continue that care until the funds promised under the Choice Program have been used. By eliminating the sunset date of the Choice Act, Congress is ensuring veterans have certainty and continuity of care while we work with the Trump administration to develop a strategic plan that addresses the need for veteran-centric coordinated network of care that utilizes the strengths of both VA and community health providers," end of quote. The press release this past week further stated H.R. 369 makes good on the promise that Congress has made to our veterans and will allow for the continued progress toward comprehensive VA reform. I would urge our veterans and our listeners that if you're interested in supporting this to reach out to your congressman and let him know how you feel.
Thanks, Richard. And more legislation pending before the committee includes some bills that we mentioned last week on our show, but which justify a quick review again this evening due to the importance of those issues and what is at stake for veterans. One of those is H.R. 611. It's called the VA Accountability First and Appeals Modernization Act of 2017. A similar version of that bill passed the House of Representatives in 2016, but it wasn't voted on by the Senate in 2016. And as you know, since we had the November election, we have a new Congress. It's called the 115th Congress, which just began last month in January. So they have any bill, just because the House passed it in the last Congress, that doesn't carry over to this new one. So both House and Senate are starting fresh. And this bill, with a different bill number from last year, has been reintroduced. So it's back again. It remains to be seen if this will become law, but if it does, there are some provisions that need veterans' attention. The law has two main goals. First, to make it easier for the VA to hold its employees accountable and make it easier for the secretary of the VA to demote or fire employees who need to go. The other major goal is to make changes in the appeals process for veterans' disability claims. That part of the law would end the VA's current legal duty to assist veterans in developing their claims after the VA makes its first decision on the case. Currently, that duty to assist exists both in the initial claim development as well as through the Board of Veterans Appeals, the appeal stage. But this proposed law would eliminate that duty after the VA makes its first decision. And that's, in my opinion, that's a very bad idea. So I ask veterans, let your voices be heard to Congress on this one. It's very important. The VA, first of all, does a pretty shabby job in assisting veterans who generally see the VA as an adversarial party from the very start when they're filing a claim for disability compensation. Now, that would only get worse if this part of the law is passed, because the VA will have little incentive to do any better than it is now. And it won't have anything to do at all to help the veterans develop their claims and gather evidence after that initial decision, which is sometimes a denial or at least a very low, unfairly low rating of their disabilities. Now, another very bad idea in this bill is that it would eliminate the duty of a decision review officer. A decision review officer we refer to as a DRO. That's the first tier of the appeals process. It would eliminate the duty of that decision review officer to accept new evidence and instead would base the decision only on the evidence in the record as it exists at that time, which, as I said earlier, is usually very poorly developed. In other words, it's pretty superficial in cases that end up being appealed. And that poor development is usually due to a combination of the VA not assisting the veteran in the first place, and most veteran service officers from veterans groups who help veterans, they put way too much faith in the VA rather than trying to build a really strong case for the veterans they're trying to help. Now, overall, as I said last week, I give that part of the bill, this H.R. 611, a big thumbs down, and I urge listeners to contact their representatives in the House and their two U.S. senators to voice their concerns and hopefully their opposition to attempts to overhaul the appeal system with this very complicated mess offered by H.R. 611. Now, the bill was sponsored by Congressman Doug Lamborn of Colorado. And as of the end of this past week, it had 27 co-sponsors in the House of Representatives. Now, there's a counterpart to this in the Senate. And the Senate bill is S-152. That's S-152. It's sponsored by Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, which is my home state. He has three co-sponsors so far. Those are Senator John McCain of Arizona, Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, and Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa. And again, I urge listeners to let your voices be heard. Just today, I sent a lengthy email to Senator Rubio's office. I've just had a very pro forma response so far, but I've asked them, you know, with very detailed reasoning why they should oppose it, and I've asked them to contact me so we can discuss it further. We'll see if they do that. If they don't, I'll follow up. But I really urge veterans to pay attention Richard, I know you have some other bills to talk about tonight.
Yeah, David, I'm kind of surprised, you know, with Senator Rubio here in Florida, and I think the state of Florida has the second or third highest population of veterans.
Yes.
I think California is number one, and Texas is two. I'm kind of surprised Rubio would. Anyway,
well, what's also surprising, if I could add, what's also surprising is, as I mentioned last week, that this idea had the support of several major veterans groups, and this proposal didn't come out of thin air. It was the product of a working group that started March of this past year and had membership from the VA, the Board of Veterans Appeals, and these large veteran groups, and they came up with these ideas, but in the report of three of these veterans groups, by their own admission, this very complicated configuration of new steps in the appeals process, along with eliminating the VA's duty to assist and other dramatic changes, have really caused, you know, some people to be extremely cautious about the implementation, because it's going to create another system on top of the existing system, and it really does nothing to end the backlog, the number you mentioned earlier, about 480,000 cases. So it's a mess. It will actually make things worse, in my opinion. But we'll continue to track this. Hopefully, it'll never get out of committee. But
if anyone out there wants to join in on the discussion about this this bill and your own opinions about it, and how it, if you're a veteran, how you think it might affect your situation, again, please call us at 1-888-627-6008. Remember, this is the Veterans News Hour. This is the Veterans Show. And we try to gear this show toward the veterans. So if you have any questions, please call in. There's another bill of interest, David, to veterans who served in the military long enough to earn a military pension. And that's H.R. 303, which is being offered by our own Congressman Bill Arrakis of Florida. It is called the Retired Pay Restoration Act. If passed, this bill would allow the receipt of both military retired pay and veterans disability compensation with respect to any service-connected disability. Currently, the law allows concurrent receipt of both a military pension and a VA disability compensation only for a combined disability rating of 50% or more. If enacted into law, veterans who were retired or separated from military service due to a service-connected disability shall be eligible for the full concurrent receipt of both veterans disability compensation and either military retired pay or combat-related special pay. And I know we have a number of clients that this affects directly. Some of them are at 30 or 40%. And I think one of them recently said to me, I feel like I'm paying myself.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, that's the reason for why the law is so important. Another proposed bill of interest to many veterans is H.R. 809, sponsored by Congressman Dennis Ross of Florida. It would amend Title 38 United States Code to clarify the presumptions regarding service connection relating to the exposure of herbicides such as Agent Orange for certain veterans who served in the armed forces during the Vietnam era. It would basically expand the presumption that veterans were exposed to these herbicides, including Agent Orange, beyond just the territory of Vietnam. It would also extend it to Guam, the Northern Mariana Islands, American Samoa, and it would also make these amendments, if they were enacted, retroactively effective back to September 25, 1985. Now, the reason why these other areas, including the territorial seas of Vietnam, Guam, Northern Mariana Islands, and American Samoa, are important is because these herbicides were used in those other areas. You may wonder, Guam, we weren't at war with Guam. You're absolutely right, but it was used for, it's actually a military installation there, U.S. military installation, but these defoliants were used to clear the growth and keep areas clean of growth surrounding airfields, for instance, and other military buildings. So one of Congressman Ross's constituents in Florida was an Air Force sergeant who actually spent quite a while serving at Guam, and he testified that he was personally responsible for spraying thousands of gallons of Agent Orange around that installation, and he's now suffering from cancer. So that's the impetus for that particular law. And there's a related law as far as Agent Orange. Richard, I think you were going to talk about that law.
Yeah, and that the sergeant major who was at Guam, Foster. He's from Lakeland, and he was at the Anderson Air Force Base, and he has very vivid descriptions of what he experienced and saw while he was stationed there. And then finally, another interest to Navy veterans who served off the coast of Vietnam during the war is H.R. 299, which added ever co-sponsors this past week and currently has 194 co-sponsors so far. It is called the Blue Water Navy Vietnam Veterans Act of 2017. This bill includes, as part of the Republic of Vietnam, its territorial seas for purposes of the presumption of service connection for diseases associated with exposure by veterans to certain herbicide agents while in Vietnam. You know, David, it's great to see that Congress is starting to expand a lot of these rules to help get our servicemen and women more potential compensation.
Yeah, well, there are proposals at this point, so veterans really need to speak up, particularly if they're affected, or family members of veterans that may have been affected. And it couldn't be easier in this day and age to stay in contact and to communicate with members of Congress. Websites, as I mentioned, other shows, the House Committee on Veterans Affairs, their website, it's easy to remember. It's veterans.house.gov, veterans.house.gov. And the Senate Committee on Veteran Affairs website is veterans.senate.gov. And you go to those websites, and you can get their phone numbers. You can email the committee, send them messages. You can find out who's on the committee, contact them. And the websites for each of the House and the Senate, you can find out who your representative is in the House of Representatives and who your two U.S. senators are. Find out if they sponsor any of these bills and see what their position is, either sponsoring or co-sponsoring, and communicate your views. That's very important. We encourage you to do that.
Thanks for that information, David. As you said, it's important for people to keep track of what's going on in Washington because it affects people's lives. Okay, after all that serious stuff, though, it's time for some levity with our military and veterans humor segment. Here's a story that I hope most veterans will enjoy. A few years back, a farm boy from Kentucky signed up to join the Army. At boot camp, his drill sergeant was having a tough time indoctrinating the young man to military life. One day, as the drill sergeant was yelling at the recruit, a fly kept buzzing around the drill sergeant's head. Trying to swat the fly away, the drill sergeant only got more frustrated. The young recruit finally spoke up. "You know, drill sergeant, that's what we used to call circle flies back in Kentucky." The drill sergeant replied, "Circle flies? What are you talking about?" The recruit said, "Well, sir, they're called circle flies because they always fly in the circles around the rear end of a horse." The drill sergeant then hollered, "Son, are you calling me a horse's ass?" To which the recruit replied, "Oh, no, sir. I'd never say that. Of course, my granddad used to say you never could fool a circle fly."
That's a good one. That's a good one. Let me see if I can top that one, Richard. Here's another story. The company commander and the first sergeant were out in the field with their troops. As they hit the sack for one night, the first sergeant says to the CO, "Sir, look up into the sky and tell me what you see." The CEO says, "I see millions of stars." First sergeant says, "What does that tell you, sir?" The CEO replied, "Well, astronomically, it tells me that there are millions of galaxies and potentially billions of planets. Theologically, it tells me that God is great and that we are small and insignificant. Meteorologically, it tells me that we will have a beautiful day tomorrow. What does it tell you, Top?" First sergeant replies, "Well, sir, it tells me that someone stole our tent."
That's good.
All right, Richard, let's move on to our next topic tonight, our Veterans History segment.
Very good. Yes, tonight I would like, in honor of U.S. President's Day, I would like to discuss the presidents who were veterans and the highest rank held by them in uniform service This afternoon, I had an opportunity to speak to a group of veterans at a luncheon. And in preparing for the luncheon, I was surprised by the fact that out of the 45 presidents that we've had, 26 are veterans. And the room was very surprised. We know of the obvious ones, but I'm going to go through them and see if any of these are somewhat of a surprise to you, and maybe your favorite president's on the list, or maybe he's not. George Washington, obviously, he was the general commander-in-chief of the Continental Army from 1775 to 1783. Thomas Jefferson was the colonel of Virginia militia from 1770 to 1779. James Madison was colonel of the Virginia militia, 1775 to 1781. James Monroe was a major in the Continental Army from 1775 to 1778. Andrew Jackson, Major General in the U.S. Army from 1814 to 1821. William Henry Harrison was a Major General in the Kentucky Militia from 1812 to 1814. John Tyler was a Captain in the Virginia Militia in 1812. James Pope was a Colonel in the Tennessee Militia in 1821. Zachary Taylor was a Major General in the U.S. Army from 1805 to 1815 and 1816 to 1849. Millard Fillmore was a major in the Union Continentals Home Guard, 1861. Franklin Pierce, a brigadier general in the Hampshire Militia from 1846 to 1848. James Buchanan was a private in the Pennsylvania Militia, 1814. Abraham Lincoln was a captain in the Illinois Militia in 1832, personally one of my favorites. Andrew Johnson was a brigadier general in the U.S. Army Volunteers from 1862 to 1865. Ulysses S. Grant was general in the U.S. Army from 1866 to 1869. Rutherford B. Hayes was a major general in the U.S. Army Volunteers, 1861 to 1865. James A. Garfield was a major general in the U.S. Army Volunteers from 1861 to 1863. Chester A. Arthur, brigadier general, New York Militia, 1858 to 1863. Benjamin Harrison, Brigadier General, U.S. Army Volunteers, 1862 to 1865. William McKinley, Brevet Major, U.S. Army Volunteers, 1861 to 1865. Theodore Roosevelt was a Colonel in U.S. Army Volunteers, 1898. Harry S. Truman was a Colonel in the Army Officer Reserve Corps in 1919 to 1945. Dwight D. Eisenhower was General of the Army of the U.S. Army from 1915 to 1948, 1951 to 1952. John F. Kennedy, Lieutenant, U.S. Naval Reserve, 1941-1945. Lyndon B. Johnson, Commander in the U.S. Naval Reserve, 1940-1964. Richard M. Nixon, Commander of the U.S. Naval Reserve, 1942-1966. Gerald Ford, Lieutenant Commander, U.S. Naval Reserve, 1942-1946. Jimmy Carter, Lieutenant, U.S. Navy, 1946-1953. Ronald Reagan was a captain in the U.S. Army from 1942 to 1945. George Bush, Lieutenant Junior Grade, U.S. Navy, 1942 to 1945. Finally, George W. Bush, First Lieutenant, Texas Air National Guard, 1968 to 1973. The most decorated, George Washington, he was General Commander-in-Chief, Continental Army, had one of the longest military careers of any former elected official. He fought in the French and Indian Wars and was a commander of the Virginia Regiment before he took over the Continental Army and under his leadership defeated the British. He was the first and only president to personally lead troops into a potential battle when he was president, when in 1794, an aging Washington boarded his horse and led 13,000 men to quell the Whiskey Rebellion. The rebels scattered without a fight. Next, Andrew Jackson, Major General of the U.S. Army. President Jackson fought tirelessly while in the military. He commanded forces against the Creek Indians in the War of 1812, and he won an overwhelming victory at the Battle of New Orleans against the British in 1815. In 1817, working as the commander of the military Southern forces, Jackson ordered an invasion of Spanish-held Florida, leading to the capture of Pensacola and St. Marks. These victories helped to set the stage for the future annexation of the state of Florida in 1821. He was the first and only U.S. president to have killed a man in a duel. He later survived the first attempted assassination of an American president by beating a would-be assassin with his cane. I'd love to see that today. Zachary Taylor, Major General of the U.S. Army. He earned the nickname Old Rough and Ready for his reputation for serving alongside his soldiers enduring the same hardships they did. He participated in the Indian Wars, often protecting the Native Americans from expanding white settlements. He became truly famous in the Mexican-American War when with just a force of 6,000 men, he defeated Santa Anna's army of 20,000. During this battle, Santa Anna demanded surrender, but Taylor declined, saying, "I beg leave to say that I decline accepting to your request." Next, Ulysses S. Grant, while fighting the Mexican-American War and during the Battle of Chapultepec, Grant dragged a howitzer into a church steeple to bombard the Mexican forces. He retired in 1854 to become a school teacher, but in 1861, he joined the Union Army and had a string of victories in the war's western frontier. Lincoln would eventually appoint him a general of the Union Army, and he would put down the Confederacy, preserving the Union. Theodore Roosevelt, he was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy. When war broke out, he resigned his post and volunteered for command of the U.S. Volunteer Cavalry, better known as the Rough Riders. The Rough Riders are known for charging up Kettle Hill and San Juan Hill outside of Santiago, Cuba, and securing a victory. Roosevelt was vice president under McKinley, who would be assassinated by an anarchist. Roosevelt was sworn in as president in 1901, reelected in 1904. He grew disheartened with the Republican Party, and in 1912, he sought presidency under a new progressive party called the Bull Moose Party. While campaigning in Milwaukee, he was shot in the chest shortly before giving a speech. The bullet was slowed by his steel eyeglass case and a thick copy of the speech he kept in his jacket pocket. He decided to give the 90-minute speech. As he began his speech, he said, and I quote, "Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know whether you fully understand that I have just been shot, but it takes more than that to kill a bull moose." Dwight D. Eisenhower, General of the Army, a graduate of West Point, he became the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe. He was named Supreme Commander Allied Expeditionary Force of the North African Theater of Operations. He repelled Axis forces' presence in North Africa and invaded Sicily in this 1 year in North Africa. Under his command, the Allies successfully planned and executed the Normandy invasion, a turning point in WW2. John F. Kennedy, Lieutenant U.S. Naval Reserve. Kennedy was best known for his role at the helm of PT-109, which was sliced in half by a Japanese destroyer. Kennedy led his crew on a three-mile swim to an island where they would eventually be rescued. He was awarded the Navy and Marine Corps Medal for his heroics, as well as the Purple Heart. Gerald Ford, Lieutenant Commander, U.S. Naval Reserve, enlisted during the height of World War II. He took part in numerous campaigns on board the Monterey against the Japanese Navy. He earned the Asiatic Pacific Campaign Medal, 9 Engagement Stars, the Philippine Medal, 2 Bronze Stars, the American Campaign, and the WW2 Victory Medals. George H.W. Bush, Lieutenant Junior Grade, U.S. Navy. He enlisted after the attack on Pearl Harbor at 19. He became a naval aviator, the youngest at the time. He flew 58 combat missions. On many occasions, he flew and fought under heavy enemy fire. On September 2, 1944, at the age of 19, Bush piloted a Grumman TBM Avenger on a mission to bomb a communication station on a small Japanese island called Tsushima. With him on the mission were 2 radio airmen, John Delaney and William White. The aircraft was struck by intense anti-aircraft fire on the mission, with the cockpit filling with smoke and with Bush expecting the plane to explode at any minute. He completed his bombing run, flew as far as he could over the water, instructed the 2 men to bail out, and then he parachuted out of the aircraft. He received the Distinguished Flying Cross, 3 air medals, and the Presidential Union Citation awarded San Jacinto. So this evening, as part of our Veterans History segment, we salute all our presidents who served in the United States military.
Thank you, Richard. That's a great summary. I'd like to now shift our focus and spend a few minutes talking about an issue facing some veterans who received an other than honorable discharge characterization or a punitive discharge, such as a bad conduct discharge or a dishonorable discharge. The issue is this. Some veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, have engaged in misconduct that resulted in an adverse discharge characterization that resulted in the loss of VA benefits. Those veterans may wish to pursue a discharge upgrade, in other words, changing their other than honorable conditions discharge characterization to something higher, like a general discharge or possibly an honorable discharge. Those veterans may wish to pursue a discharge upgrade through the respective discharge review board. Each service has their own discharge review board, and or the Board for Correction of Military Records, or for the Navy and the Marine Corps, the Board for Correction of Naval Records. Those are two administrative boards that have a great deal of authority, which includes upgrading discharge characterization. Now, this is very important because there are literally tens of thousands of veterans who have lost their eligibility for VA benefits because they did not receive an honorable or a general discharge. And what I want to talk about for a few minutes this evening is something that's very important for those veterans. On September 3rd of 2014, the then Secretary of Defense issued a memorandum on this very issue of discharge upgrade requests by veterans who are claiming they had PTSD. I'd like to cover some of the major points of the letter, and if anyone out there listening is in this situation or knows a veteran that is, please feel free to contact me or contact Richard Hurley, and we'll give our numbers at the end of the show. For more information, including a copy of this memorandum and more information about this discharge upgrade process. So what this memo basically says, and I'll quote, it says, recent attention has been focused upon the petitions of Vietnam veterans to military department boards for correction of military or naval records for the purposes of upgrading their discharges based on claims of previously unrecognized post-traumatic stress disorder. In these cases, PTSD was not recognized as a diagnosis at the time of service, and in many cases, diagnoses were not made until decades after service was completed. To help ensure consistency across the services, this memorandum provides supplemental policy guidance for the BCMR and the BCNR on those applications. And I'll just briefly summarize. The Department of Defense memo basically instructs the boards to keep an open mind and to have a broad consideration, a generous consideration, basically, of these sorts of petitions, and to recognize a number of things. And first of all, very often the records of these service members who served before PTSD was recognized as a diagnosis, including some that served in Vietnam, those records don't contain what the DOD would consider substantive information about those medical conditions in either the service treatment records or service personnel records. And it is therefore extremely difficult to expect these veterans to document something from records when that wasn't really part of the record keeping at that point. So basically what the DOD memo points out is that the board should be considering ways that the veteran can now document that. It recognizes that these boards are not courts and they're not investigative agencies either. And to assist these boards, what this guidance memo provides is information about what the boards ought to consider, mitigating factors, and other matters, essentially. And I'll give you an example of this. Some veterans, for instance, may have seen incredibly traumatic events in combat. And Richard and I have represented many veterans that have fallen in that situation, not just from Vietnam, but earlier wars before that, and the wars after that. And some of the things that they've told us are just really horrific, and it's not surprising that they would develop serious psychological conditions, problems, whether it's labeled as PTSD, or in prior wars before Vietnam, they'd call it shell shock or battle fatigue or any number of other things. But it really wasn't until the last few decades that the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder has become relatively common, and you see many veterans, even going back to the Vietnam War and before, filing claims. And what they run into then, the VA, one of the first forms the VA will look for is their DD-214, the summary of their service and the discharge characterization. And those that may have received an under other than honorable condition may lose their VA entitlement. So what may be a typical scenario? The veteran saw a lot of trauma over in Vietnam in combat. Drug use was rampant over in Vietnam, and we've represented many clients that, got hooked on heroin or other drugs, and you know, to be sure, some of them may have been doing that just as a way to relieve boredom or because they enjoyed, you know, the recreational use of drugs. But certainly there were some that it's fair to say, and the doctors would support it, they were essentially self-medicating to numb the psychological pain that they were undergoing at that time. And that's what this DOD memo essentially recognizes. In other words, that there may be mitigating circumstances for why these veterans got into trouble. And that trouble might be, you know, the use of possession of drugs, which may have gotten them court-martialed or at least administratively discharged with something other than an honorable conditions discharge. Many tens of thousands of veterans fall in this situation. So it's a very, very important thing to recognize that, you know, in 2014, the DOD did issue this policy. Now, this is not, I don't want to overstate it, this policy is not some sort of amnesty, but it does essentially give guidance that instructs the boards, whether it's the discharge review boards, the boards for correction of military and naval records, to basically liberally consider information of a nature, including PTSD, that might be a mitigating circumstance for misconduct which led to an unfavorable discharge. The DOD memo also instructs the boards to liberally waive the time limits for consideration. And the two different types of boards, the discharge review board has a 15-year deadline, which it normally never waives. But that's the first step. Veterans basically have two opportunities. They can apply to the discharge review board, and then if they're not successful, they can apply to the Board for Correction of Military or Naval Records, which, strangely enough, has an even shorter deadline of only 3 years. However, that board will frequently waive the 3 years in the interest of justice. And what this DOD memo from 2014 says is basically that the board should liberally waive those deadlines in the interest of justice, consistent with this guidance. So again, it's a very important issue for memos, for veterans, and the memo provides very important guidance to help veterans with adverse discharge characterizations. I believe the policy will particularly help veterans with PTSD who use illegal drugs, as I said, to basically self-medicate their PTSD, but who are then kicked out of the military because of that drug use. But it's not limited to drug use. The memo doesn't say this is only applying to misconduct involving drugs. It could be other kinds of misconduct. And therefore, if a veteran has a less than honorable discharge and wishes to upgrade that discharge in order to get VA benefits or for any other reason, it would be a good idea to consider whether this policy can help. And if you need a copy of the DOD memorandum, which is dated September 3rd, 2014, please let me know. I can be reached any day of the week. My phone number is area code 813-662-0760, and I'll repeat that. It's 813-662-0760, and Richard Hurley can be reached at area code 727-612-1515. Again, 727-612-1515. Okay, Richard, I think it's time for Hurley's tips tonight.
Yeah, and before I do, I just want to remind anyone who would like to call in, please do at 1-888-627-6008. You know, David, getting back to what you were just talking about, you know, one of the things that we've seen when we get veterans who left the service with under conditions less than honorable is they get charged with an offense, and rather than fight it, the options are kind of thrown in front of them, and they just figure, well, I'll just get out, you know, and so they sign on the dotted line, and now they're out of the service to thinking that that's going to eliminate that problem for them, for themselves, not realizing that now they're in the civilian world, and when they go looking for a job or looking for VA benefits or something, that, and it could have been just a small infraction, or what we'd like to call in the civilian world a misdemeanor, is now coming to bite them in the butt.
Right.
And now, you know, we have to go out now and apply to get that corrected. So, you know, it's the same thing. I used to see it myself handling cases for the Public Defender's Office up in New Jersey.
Right.
Same type of deal. People pleading guilty to things that they probably shouldn't plead guilty to, only to find out later on that small penalty that they pled guilty to is now becoming a huge problem. So we're right here if anyone needs help to correct that situation. And tonight for my tips, I would like to talk about the importance of veterans' medical records and claims files. This is kind of a pretty basic thing, but it's very important because David and I, we lecture around the state, and we always tell veterans to keep a copy of their VA medical records and the VA claims files, also called the C file. And so often when we get new cases and the client comes in, and one of the first questions I know I ask them and I know David asks them is, do you have your claims file? No, I don't. Do you have your medical file? No, I don't. And they were being represented by a veteran service officer or a DAV. And the response to me has always been, well, they never gave me a copy. But they are available through the VA, so you can get a copy on your own without the benefit of your representative. I know in our practice, one of the first things we do is seek a copy of both your military or your medical record and your claims file, and if necessary, your military record. And like I said, I'm kind of speaking to the, at this point, I'm speaking to the veteran who's represented by the DAV or the veteran service officer, because I find that if you terminate their services, you're going to be terminating them probably without the benefit of walking away with your claims file or your C file. A lot of times when the veteran comes to me after he's terminated with a representative, and I say, do you have your file? And he says, oh, yeah, I got my file. And he hands me three or four pages, which is generally the cover letters to the VA. So I urge all veterans to be aggressive with your representatives and insist that you get a copy of your C file, your claims file, and your medical records. If you are one of the fortunate few who have a copy of your C file medical records, then hang on to them. And Dave and I always, when we're representing someone and they do have a copy of the military and C file, we take a copy of that and make our own copy and give that original copy back to the veteran, because we both feel and it's absolutely necessary that the veteran maintains at all times a copy of both files. David, this advice seems like basic advice, but unfortunately, when a veteran gives us their C file, it's an exception and not the rule. The C file contains all the relevant information pertaining to your claim. It has your medical record, but not a copy. Your medical record might not contain a copy of your C&P exam. The VA decision is based primarily on what is or is not in this file. In other words, in the C file. Every level of the claims process looks at the VAC file. The decision review officer might carry a copy into the hearing or conference or access online. Medical examiners have to certify that they have reviewed the C file or their decision might lack credibility. If the VBA, which is the benefit side of the VHA, can't find your C file, it may conclude you are not a veteran or you never filed a claim. Absence of evidence is evidence against the claim. When I open a new case, I instruct all my clients to get a binder, and every letter, document, medical evidence, or factual evidence which I file with the VA gets placed in that binder. Then the client will know exactly where the case stands, and if for any reason the veteran needs a copy of his file, then he or she will have it. This is pretty basic advice, yes, but it is so essential that I would be remiss if I didn't take time to mention it as a Hurley tip. My second tip tonight is a reminder about the huge number of job vacancies which the VA has, particularly in healthcare. If you are looking for a paying job, the VA has 45,300 vacancies around the country. Go to www.va.gov/jobs/ for more information. And before we end the show tonight, we want to remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs has the Veterans Crisis Line to help. Call 1-800-273-8255. That number again is 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they didn't get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line can help at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
Now, Richard, I'd like to add to what you've said about the importance of VA medical records and VA claims files, and that veterans keep a copy. And, you know, the VA has made an effort in recent years to go electronic as much as possible, and they have two separate electronic systems of records that I encourage veterans to sign up for and to use. We have many clients that have done that, but many clients, probably many more, that haven't. And to get copies of VA claims letters, rating decisions, appeals documents, and any other paperwork correspondence between you and the VA, you can often access that online if you've signed up for what the VA calls the e-benefits program. And that's accessible through the VA website, which is va.gov, and then look for the links for e-benefits. That's to access claims documents. And the VA has tried in recent years to scan these voluminous paper claims files into electronic PDF files. And we always make it a point of asking the VA to provide us with electronic. It's so much easier to have it on a computer disk. You can save it to your computer. And you can also do word searches much faster through a PDF file. So e-benefits, sign up for that if you're a veteran. Now, what about your veteran medical records? The VA has a separate portal or program for that, basically. It's called the My Health eVet. That's MyHealthEVet. That's the My Health eVet website. You need to sign up for it. So go online to va.gov and then look for the My Health eVet website. But you sign up for that and you can get documents regarding your VA medical care history. You can download records, and you can save it onto your computer or put it on a computer disk and provide it to your representative. And you can check it frequently. It's certainly much faster than having to put in a written request to the Release of Information office and then having to wait a month or two for the health records. And when you're asking for your C file from the VA, it can be 6 months or longer, unfortunately. So use those two programs, sign up for them, e-benefits and the My Health eVet's websites, and that'll make processing of your case and preparation of your case so much easier. So I really encourage everyone to do that. I know we're rapidly reaching the end of our show for tonight. I know, Richard, we've got an excellent program scheduled for next week. We have a guest. We have to wrap up in a couple of minutes. But, Richard, you want to tell us quickly about our guest for next week?
Yes, next week we're going to have Hank Whittier. Hank is a veteran, and he runs the Veteran Services in Ocala, Ocala, Florida, Marion County. And he's done an absolutely tremendous job for the veterans in the Marion County area as well as the surrounding counties. And they have a brand new building that they're opening up, which he'll talk about. And he's a great guy, I tell you. I had a vet over today, a young vet from, I guess, Iraq War, and young man, and he was saying to me, if it wasn't for Hank Whittier, he doesn't know where he'd be today. He said Hank's been like a father to him. And I know Hank's been like that to a lot of people.
Right. His organization, Vets Helping Vets of Marion County, is really super. And we're having Hank on the show next week so he can share his experience and expertise with other veteran groups around the country. So we look forward to that. We really invite you to listen in. We want to thank all of you for listening in tonight to our show here on BBS Radio. As you know, we have a weekly show. We're here every Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 Central Time, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, and 6 p.m. Pacific on bbsradio.com, Station 1. You can listen to the show through our website, bbsradio.com/TheVeteransNewsHour. We'd like to thank our producer at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom, for the great job he's done for us. and we invite listeners to become show guests, sponsors, and advertisers. Call me, David Corey, at 813-662-0760 or Richard Hurley, 727-612-1515 if you're interested. That's our show for tonight. Please tune in next week for another great show.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on VBSRadio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.